This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The Rocky Mountains of North America, home to some of the most beautiful, pristine forests in the world. But the shades of burnt gold and reds aren't the changing tones of autumn. They're dead and dying trees.
We're looking at tree mortality over a scale of tens of millions of hectares in the last decade alone.
In fact, right across the globe, there are reports of trees dying in mass numbers. From Europe, from Africa, even right across the Amazon, and right here in Australia.
Teeming green. Green brain facing lobotomy. Climate control center for the world. Ancient cord of coexistence hacked by parasitic greenhead scam. From Sarawak to Amazonas, Costa Rica to mangy BC hills. If a tree falls in the forest, does anybody hear? Does anybody hear?
A startling documentary from the public broadcaster ABC Australia explores dying forests. It is happening all around the world, in Europe, Asia, Africa, South America, and all down the west coast of North America. Call it bugs, call it fungus, call it drought and record heat, call it climate change and plain old pollution. Whether it's satellite photos or you walking through the dying woods, it's heartbreaking. Why are the forests dying around the world? I'm Alex Smith. I've covered climate change in so many Radio EcoShock programs. Find them in our website. Later in this program, we'll talk to a key scientist, Lisa Ainsworth, about misplaced expectations that rising carbon dioxide levels will green the planet and feed billions more people. But first, we are going to ground with a citizen activist from New Jersey. Her trees, and all our trees, are weakened and dying from a much simpler cause, plain old pollution. The air looks cleaner, but all that industrial exhaust is still deadly to plants and our lungs. The trees are talking to us, but we just aren't listening.
Radio EcoShock.
One of the brightest plays now on Broadway is Paint Your Wagon, for which Frederick Lowe has written a brilliant score. As his next number, Thomas L. Thomas, accompanied by the Firestone Chorus, sings a special arrangement of one of the hit tunes from this gay musical play, entitled I Talk to the Tree.
I talk to the trees, but they don't listen to me. I talk to the stars, but they never hear me.
In New Jersey, Gail Sawacki noticed trees and other plants were dying. She spent countless hours finding out why, and the real villain may surprise you. It's not all global warming, and the cause is all around you, hurting your lungs as well. I'm Alex Smith, saying Gail Sawacki, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex.
I'd like to ask you, you know, we've had emails back and forth for a couple of years. I'm busy tracking droughts and global warming in my many radio programs. And for a while there, your cause just didn't click with me. And then from your website, I did see that TV documentary by the ABC Australia program called Catalyst. And it was very shocking about tree deaths in Australia and around the world. There was another news story out of Australia questioning whether trees there would survive at all. And living here in the dying pine forest of British Columbia, I've seen it myself. So, Gail, what made you first fear for the trees?
Well, the very first, I have a little farm, and I love trees. So I've planted quite a few of them, and perhaps for that reason more than a lot of people that take them for granted or perhaps live in cities and don't really see them that much. I pay very close attention to them. And it was in the summer of 2008. It had been quite dry, but towards the end of the summer, all of a sudden, the leaves on the trees wilted. It was the most astonishing thing I had ever seen. They simply just went limp everywhere. And I found it very frightening. So I started trying to understand what was happening to them. And my first thought was that it was drought. And from there, I thought it was an extended drought from climate change. So I started to learn everything I could about climate change. And really, for about a year, I was pretty convinced that that was the reason that the trees were dying, and other symptoms started showing up quite quickly, that they were in decline. And the first reactions I got from most people that I wrote to, I started writing a lot of different government agencies and newspaper editors and scientists, and the first reaction I got was, oh, don't be ridiculous. The trees are fine. Maybe your trees in your yard have a problem, but everywhere else they're okay. Since then, there have been some very large studies done by much more credentialed professionals than me that have shown that, in fact, all over the world, the trees are dying. But what happened was, in the summer of 2009, as I was watching very carefully to see what was happening, I realized that plants and trees that exhibit ozone symptoms of damage, which are very classic, they've been known for years, and there's all kinds of resources that people can go to see what ozone damaged leaves look like. But what I saw was that plants and trees that were being watered had the exact same degree of damage on their leaves as trees that were going out in forests. So the idea that it's drought simply doesn't fit the evidence. You'll find lots of people that will ignore that evidence, but it really doesn't fit the evidence. Even aquatic plants like lotus and water lilies that are in water all of the time have the same kind of damage to their leaves. So it's not that I don't think that drought is a problem or climate change, as I definitely do, but I don't think climate change is happening fast enough to explain the really rapid die-off that's going on with trees, that it's quite visible and well documented around the world at this point.
Right. This isn't just happening in your neck of the woods or mine. I mean, I looked at that documentary. They had quick snapshots of a whole dead forest in Spain, and we had news reports of Bangladesh and Africa, dying trees. It's pretty scary.
It is. It's happening. You can look. Actually, if you just Google dying trees and then put in any place, put in India or Japan or Hawaii or Mexico, you will get all kinds of, just endless news articles about people being concerned about trees dying off. But the thing is that they almost always will blame some local influence. In other words, this tree is like the California live oaks are dying from a fungus, and the pine trees are dying from a bark beetle, and the hemlocks are dying from the woolly adelgid, and it will go on and on and on. Fungus, bugs, disease, drought. But the thing is that all of these, what they call biotic factors, well, drought would be an abiotic factor, but the others that are living things, diseases, you know, bacteria and so forth, those are the biotic factors. They have always existed. And they've existed in harmony with trees. They have a job. Their job is that when the tree's dying, they move in and they break that tree down and return the nutrients that are locked up in that tree to the soil, and it's part of the whole ecological cycle. So to me, I'm not a scientist, so I can just say that logically it seems a little too of a convenient coincidence that suddenly all over the world, all the fungus and the disease and the bacteria and the insects are going crazy and killing trees off. There's an underlying reason, which in that ABC documentary you mentioned, finally one of the scientists, Craig Allen, mentioned something I've been saying for several years. It's like the trees have AIDS. In other words, their immune system is compromised. When somebody dies of AIDS, people don't say, oh, they died of pneumonia. That's not what killed them. The pneumonia might have been the last straw, but the problem is that they can't fight off things that they would normally have immunity to. So it's really AIDS that killed somebody who has that horrible affliction. And our trees have AIDS. They can't fight off the insects and the disease that they used to be able to have defenses against. And the reason is because they're compromised because of ozone, which is something that has been known for over 100 years, that ozone's even worse for trees than it is for people. It's bad for people, but it's worse for plants.
Well, what is ozone?
Ozone is it's a very simple concept, and it's at the same time very confusing and complicated, which is one of the reasons that most people don't know anything about it. Ozone is not a pollutant that can be regulated by itself because it doesn't get directly emitted from anything. It gets created by precursors, which are mostly reactive nitrogen that comes from burning fuel, coal and oil and gasoline and ethanol. A lot of it's coming from the huge amount of over-fertilization that's being done for industrial agriculture. So that works its way into the air, into the soil, into the rain, and it reacts in the presence of sunlight with volatile organic compounds, some of which are also released from burning fuel, and some of them are naturally occurring and actually come from trees. So you get this sort of mix, this sort of cocktail of the reactive nitrogen and the volatile organic compounds and the sunlight. And these some very complicated chemical reactions happen in the atmosphere, none of which anyone can see. But it's still going on just the same as oxygen and CO2 are out there. You can't see it, but it's there and it's happening. And that is what creates ozone. So that's how Ronald Reagan got away with saying trees create pollution, because it does require the volatile organic compounds. But if there wasn't the reactive nitrogen from industrial processes, the volatile organic compounds would never turn into ozone in the first place. It's a very highly reactive gas, and anything that it comes into contact with, whether it's your lungs or the leaves of trees or even monuments, you know, granite gets eaten away by it. Or there were reports in the 50s when they had very high peaks in Los Angeles that women would literally have their nylon stockings melt on their legs. That was from ozone.
So you brought up a really important point. There's no factory churning out ozone that we could just shut down their smokestacks. This is a complicated chemical process that, as you say, it requires the precursors, and we talked about nitrogen. And you talk about the nitrogen cascade. What is that, and why does that matter?
Well, that's another thing. It's actually been called the worst environmental disaster you've never heard of. It's inextricably linked to ozone because it ends up being ozone a lot of the time, but for some reason in science, things tend to get compartmentalized and treated as specialties separately, which is too bad because it means that we're missing the big picture. The nitrogen cascade is being used in that sense as like a waterfall, but as one thing will occur and then that will then trigger chain reactions, each one of which is magnified from the one before. So if you put, as we are doing constantly, reactive nitrogen into the environment, it moves through various stages, and each one is impacted and even further impacts on the next sort of stage. So it gets into the water, it gets into the air, it gets into the soil, and it's, as I said before, it's coming from multiple sources. And it's a very big problem. It's also called an intractable problem. And the scientists mean by that is that there's no simple way to stop it because it's intrinsic to our modern lifestyle in the developed world. We use it and we produce it in enormous amounts. And the only way to really address it is to cut back on the kind of profligate use we have of energy and the industrial agricultural processes that we're sort of addicted to at this point.
And we even grow some crops that create nitrogen, like soy, I guess, would be one, and other nitrogen fixers. I always thought that was a good thing, but apparently that's just adding to this overcapacity of nitrogen.
Well, yeah, what's adding to it mostly, though, is the chemical fertilizers, which is what created the Green Revolution, which was what has led to this huge exponential growth in human population. There's so much food, and unfortunately, it can't last. The Earth Policy Institute came out with a release yesterday that's really frightening about the Mideast and how much grain they import, which is increasing every year. Their population's increasing every year, and their own production is plummeting. Because when you have that industrial monoculture that we're using to grow huge amounts of food, you deplete the quality of the soil, and you just basically burn everything out with all those nitrogen fertilizers, and it's simply not sustainable. So it's a gigantic problem.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Gail Sawacki, and we're talking about trees dying around the world and much more. And, you know, Gail, people like to hear about themselves first, so before we get to the big impact on plants, what are the human health effects of this low-lying ozone?
Yeah, as opposed to the stratospheric ozone, which we should make that clear. They're not the same thing at all. The stratospheric ozone hole that we heard about is far, far above at the top levels of our atmosphere, and it's good, and it's natural. It was there before people were here, but the low level that is the issue that comes from burning fuel and the other processes of industrialized civilization. That's very unhealthy. It's kind of like driving cars. People seem to be willing to accept a certain amount of sort of collateral damage. We want to drive our cars so we know that there's a certain number of car accidents, and we just hope that it doesn't happen to us or somebody we love. And the same thing's been true so far with tropospheric ozone. It's very well known that it causes lung cancer, emphysema, asthma, allergies, heart disease, and it's been linked to other problems of developed nations like diabetes and autism. So it's almost like we sort of turn a blind eye and don't want to acknowledge that we're creating these. They're all epidemics. All the things I mentioned are epidemics, and we're creating them ourselves. But it's a trade-off so far that we've been willing to make, and it just remains to be seen how soon it will be before people are unwilling to accept that. Personally, my daughter got cancer, so my sense of how close that comes to home has been very much heightened since that occurred, especially because she lived a very, very healthy lifestyle, very active physically. We live out in a very rural area, and that's one of the things that people don't know about ozone. There was a woman painting a picture down the road from where I live one day, and she was painting a landscape, and I stopped and I was talking to her, and I asked her about what she thought about the trees. And interestingly, she was painting them with a lot more leaves than they actually had. There were all these sort of bare branches sticking out. She didn't put that in her painting. So I started talking to her about it, and I mentioned something about the pollution, and she looked up at this beautiful blue sky, and she said, "Well, there's no pollution here." And I said, "Well, yes, there is. We just can't see it. But it's there, and it's a big problem. It's what they call in the Environmental Protection Agency, they refer to it as the policy relevant background level, PRB. It's the constant level because they've reduced the high peaks that we used to hear about so much, especially in cities. But what's happened is that as the precursors increase, especially with the revolution and growth development in Asia, that means that all over the world, even in very, very rural places where you wouldn't think there would be a problem, that background level is going up and up and up. So that if you're only measuring the peaks, you might say, oh, we've really improved air pollution. But if you're looking at the persistent background level, it is going up and up and up everywhere.
It can spread that far because, I mean, could ozone, there are places that aren't even near big cities. You've got forests dying in Africa where there isn't that much. Can it go that far?
Absolutely. If you think about it, just recently I saw a study, it's not related, but they just found a whole bunch of radioactive isotopes buried in the ice in Greenland that had come from our atomic testing in the Pacific and in the American West. And they were using them to date the levels of ice because they can trace it to different explosions of nuclear tests. But we really live in a closed system and things travel around. And there's, well, and we'll talk later, I guess, about this thing I wrote up about ozone, but there have been several major studies in the last 3 years that have tracked Asian pollution coming to the Western U.S. So those areas where people like to say the bark beetle is attacking trees because it's warm in Colorado, that's dead central for where that ozone turns up that started out in China.
And when we look at trees and plants, I know you've written quite a bit about this, but I was surprised. I looked at pictures on your website at Wits End, and I thought, I know about plants, but then I realized, well, these patterns on the leaves that you're showing and this damage to the needles, I'm seeing it right around me in Vancouver, which is supposed to have nice clean air. So tell us, what does it do to the trees and plants? What should we be looking for?
Well, there's two important things to keep in mind. First of all, there's no test for ozone because, as I said, it's very reactive. It breaks down and does bad things as soon as it's absorbed. So the way that researchers have determined where it is impacting vegetation is because it leaves damage behind on leaves. But a very important facet of this to understand is that generally, before you see the damage on the leaves, there's already damage inside that you don't see, especially in the roots. So trees that have been exposed to ozone tend to have their root systems shrivel up. And that's why you see them falling over in the wind when they didn't used to fall over in the wind and the branches didn't used to break as much as they do. And they're doing that because there's internal damage. So that's just the sheer number of trees that you can see falling down now is indicative of some kind of issue going on internally. And as far as the visual impacts that you can see, there's two things to look for, and your audience might want to just go outside at some point and look for this, especially it's early in the spring in the northern hemisphere, but as the summer goes on, it will become much more obvious. So you've got leaf issues, and first thing that you would see is what they call stippling. It looks kind of like little speckles, and then you can have bronzing where the color gets more intense. And then that goes into chlorosis, which means the problem is that the leaves aren't photosynthesizing and producing chlorophyll. This whole process gets disrupted by the ozone when it enters the stomates. So the leaves start to look yellow. And then they've got necrosis, that's a great word, which means they actually look dead. I mean, they'll just turn brown or black and fall off. And one thing you can see that's very typical is that the older leaves that are lower on a plant, or like the inner leaves of like an evergreen, like hollies or boxwood or any kind of pine tree, those older needles or leaves inside that have had more seasons of exposure, they look worse than the newer growth. And a lot of times they'll just fall off. So you get these kind of like hollow shells of perennial evergreens, and they call it a tufted look on pine trees when they've got like new needles at the end of the branch, like a tuft, but the older needles have fallen off. So those are all things that you can find on trees. You can find them on plants that are flowering, ornamental plants that people put in their pots that they water. Even tropical things like, marigolds or nasturtiums or morning glories. They're not, you know, this idea that the temperature's changed and that's why they're having problems. Those things are meant to grow in tropical areas. So if somebody in New England or Vancouver is growing an ornamental flower like that for the summer, and those leaves have that damage, it's not the temperature. It's the ozone that they're absorbing. And another thing is as you get to the fall, after the end of the summer, a very typical problem is what they call premature senescence, and that means that the leaves fall off earlier than they should. And they also don't show their fall color. They don't get those in New England, and I think it's true in actually a number of places around the world, that in the fall the leaves turn these brilliant, gorgeous, bright colors. And that's been... Well, there's been scientific measurements done over the past few years that's documented that that color is disappearing.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Gail Sawaki from New Jersey about the impacts of common air pollution. And you also, in an email, wrote to me, look, we should be talking about the impacts on food crops. Everybody's worried about the food crisis. Let's look at what ozone is doing to our agriculture.
That's a really large area of research. And it's important because it just begs the question. They've documented so many times using controlled fumigation in chambers that ozone damages agricultural annual crops. All of them, really. I mean, some of them are more tolerant than others, but they're all susceptible to damage. So whether it's soybeans or corn or wheat or rice or any of the other less important crops like spinach or parsley or whatever, all of them can be damaged by ozone. And, of course, those are all annual crops. So it's worse for trees because trees get cumulative damage, you know, season after season after season. But the annual crops are a big issue. And the USDA, for instance, and many universities have been researching for a long time, trying to develop genetically tolerant strains of crops, which to me is just ironic because even if they could do that, which they have not actually been able to do, but even if they could, that's not going to do anything for the wild vegetation. We can't genetically engineer all the forests in the world to be more tolerant to ozone. So it's really sort of a desperate measure, I think, on their part to think that we can somehow engineer our way out of this problem.
Right. The Australian TV documentary showed somebody giving shots of nutrients to trees to build them back up after the damage they'd suffered. But we're not going to go around to all the forests of the world giving trees shots. But when we're talking about crops, you also talk about the lack of quality of protein and minerals as the plants are having to fight to get the nutrients they need. They're not able to because of this ozone pollution. Can you talk to us about that?
Well, simply, they have to allocate resources to repair the damage that's done from the ozone, which is one reason, or maybe the reason, that the roots shrink. but it also impacts the production of the nuts and seeds and the other grains that we want from them for crop. It reduces the amount, and this has all been documented, very well documented by agricultural study teams. So the actual volume gets reduced, and the quality, the nutritive quality gets reduced. So that's a problem not just for people that are eating these crops, but for animals that we give them this for feed, you know, for cows and pigs and chickens. So they're eating maybe the same volume of food, but they're not getting the same amount of protein and vitamins. And, of course, this is true, too, for wild animals, that when they're out there foraging for what they call it, when it's in the wild, they call it, at least in this country, they call it mast. And it's all the cumulative, you know, the acorns and the other nuts and the berries and whatnot that wild animals eat. They have a problem because their food is no longer as nutritious as it should be. So it really goes across the board, this issue. And another thing to keep in mind is that one thing that plants do when they are, especially trees, when they're in decline, it's kind of poetic what they do, is they almost deliberately, I guess they don't think, but they're programmed to, as a survival, to pass their genes on, they're disposed to allocate more resources to reproduction. So when they sense that they're going to die in a season or two or three, because they don't die right away, they have a lot of stored energy. They're made to be that way, like a camel. But they allocate extra energy into nut and fruit production. So the last few years, you'll see pine trees that are absolutely so covered with pine cones, you can't even see the tree. And same thing with some fruit trees, apple trees. They're just, they have so many apples, their branches are breaking. It's like a deliberate attempt they make. Of course, it doesn't last. It only works for a season or two, and then they're finished. But they do make that attempt. It's quite remarkable.
You know, I've seen this myself. I used to be a plant columnist, believe it or not, way back in my journalism days. And I noticed during the cooler winters we had in the late 70s that some of the trees that were challenged would produce many, many more seeds than we'd ever seen before. And so it is something they do. If they feel like they're going to go, they say, well, I better reproduce as much as I can before I do. So it's kind of sad. You know, when I was doing research for this, for our talk, I came across a really interesting paper in the journal Nature. It was published back in 2003 by Wendy Loya and others, and it said that tropospheric ozone has increased 35% over the last century. And they were looking at, okay, if there's more ozone, we're also going to have more carbon dioxide in planet as we keep adding more by burning fossil fuels. So plants will do better with more carbon dioxide. How does that relate to the ozone? And they concluded, and I quote, "Our results suggested that in a world with elevated atmospheric carbon dioxide concentrations, global scale reductions in plant productivity due to elevated ozone levels will also lower soil carbon formation rates significantly." So what they were looking at is, okay, they might do better because they've got more carbon dioxide, but because of this elevated ozone, they're going to suffer. It just seems like there's kind of a marriage between global warming and ozone pollution, that we're dancing back and forth around it.
It's true that there's a lot of, for instance, the FACE free air enrichment studies in Wisconsin, where they have these gigantic, I think they have like 20 huge chambers where they fumigate the trees. They do elevated CO2, elevated ozone. They mix them together. The scientists are very, very interested in this interaction. And it's something that I don't get all that excited about one way or the other, because I think there's a kind of CO2 obsession that has really predominated in science in the last at least 10 years. And they're not really quite that related. And scientists tend to think they like the idea that, and they'll often say, oh, yeah, ozone's bad for plants, but we can make up for that because the CO2 will take care of that. But they're two different things. I mean, they're just the kind of mechanisms that are going on from ozone damage and CO2 increasing growth are very different. And aside from that, the CO2 increasing growth has always seemed kind of specious to me, because it's kind of like saying it's good for people to eat more calories because they'll grow faster. In other words, they'll get fat. What are the long-term consequences of that? nobody really knows. I mean, there have been some studies that have shown that, and in fact, greenhouses will fumigate produce for the grocery store with CO2 because it grows faster. But is it going to have the same strength? Is it going to have the same nutrition? If you go to the grocery store and buy that greenhouse hydroponic stuff that they're fumigating, it doesn't have any flavor. So I'm quite suspect of that as CO2 somehow mitigating ozone problems.
All right. So, Gail Sawacki, how do people find out more about you and your work?
Well, my blog is the best place to go with SEND, NJ for New Jersey, .blogspot. And right at the top of that page, there's a link to a couple months ago I wrote kind of everything I could think of. So it would be one place, and that's called Pillage, Plunder, and Pollute. There's a link at the top, so if anybody wants to download that PDF, it's free. Or they could buy the book if they want to have a hard copy, which is $20 at Amazon. So that's a good place. And also, the thing that I wrote, the Pillage, Plunder, and Pollute, has huge amounts of links at the end to published research. So it's, you know, I wrote that, but it's all backed up with, for people who like to study that kind of, you know, want to go look at the chemical formulas, that's all there. Every country and every university has websites about ozone. So you can always just Google it. One place to go that's great is called ozoneinjury.org. And it's published by a European consortium. And if you go to ozone injury, so they have forest impacts, and they also have crops. So you can click on the crop link, or you can go to ozoneinjury.org/crops. And the picture you'll come up with right away is an amazing photograph, and it's of potatoes. And one of the experiments they've done, out of many, is they grew potatoes in filtered air. So, in other words, there's no pollution. This is very clean air. Then in another chamber, they grew potatoes at ambient air, which has whatever amount of pollution the ambient air has. And then they grew some potatoes in a third chamber where they had added extra ozone on top of what's out there. And the difference in the yield of potatoes is just staggering. To me, that's the biggest image. That picture speaks so many more words. To see how much we're losing in terms of crop yield and extrapolate from that to what's happening to our trees, it's pretty convincing.
And I'm sorry, I missed your blog address. Could you give it to us slowly so people who are listening on the radio might be able to kind of jot it down?
Yeah, it's Wits End. In other words, like I'm at my Wits End, WITSEND, and then NJ, like New Jersey, .blogspot.com.
Got it. Okay. Now, here's a question that we couldn't answer in 3 hours probably, but I have to ask, what can we do to clear the air? What can we do about this problem?
So that's a really hard question. And it's one reason that I'm a distinctly unpopular person, I would say, because the only way that anyone knows of is to fundamentally change the way that we live our lives. But there is a lot that we could do, which is why I do write about it, because to me, we are squandering so much fuel. We're wasting it, using it for stupid, unnecessary things like mowing lawns. People could get a sheep or a goat. And those two-stroke engines, lawn mowers and leaf blowers and things like that, they are far worse in terms of emissions than cars even. But the very notion of single-passenger vehicles is just totally unnecessary. It does take a revolution of the mind to do that, to think, well, I'm going to carpool. When I need to go to the grocery store, I'm going to go with my neighbor on the same day, and we'll go together, and things like that. But if we wanted to, for instance, in World War II, when people were faced with a really drastic threat, they took extreme measures without complaining to conserve. They conserved fuel, they rationed essential things, and people's lives weren't miserable for that. Or another example is flying. Flying is one of the worst things that you can do. One trip across country is the same as driving an SUV for 2 years. And when I grew up, the only people that flew were like movie stars and the president. I actually did fly for the first time when I was 18, but I never expected to. I was thrilled. It's not necessary for people to have this lifestyle where they think they can fly, you know, on vacation, or where people have to fly. Or the worst is these eco conferences when people fly from all over the world to get together and talk about how bad, you know, CO2 emissions are. And they get on airplanes to do it. I think there is a lot that we can do. The way I look at it is every morsel of energy that we don't squander today is something that's going to be down the road for grandchildren. But people are very selfish. So it's going to take, which is one reason I think the ozone is important. I feel like if people understood how directly we're threatening our food supply, and not just our, but the forests are the foundation of our ecosystem. They provide the oxygen that we breathe. They provide habitat for so many animals. And they keep the earth cool with evapotranspiration, by cycling the water from the soil to the air and to the rain. We really can't live without our forests. I feel like if people understood that in a visceral way, maybe then they'd say, okay, I don't really have to fly for this weekend trip after all.
As we wrap up, and I think this is related to what you're just saying, you've been blogging about your recent trips to Occupy protests. Why you and why Occupy now?
I got that first call from Adbusters last summer to Occupy Wall Street. I got excited about it instantly because it's a movement that's fundamentally challenging the way that our current society is constructed. And that's at the root of the problem of pollution and of climate change. It was a long time ago that I think it was Andrew Jackson complained about or warned about a system where the production of finances and everything is privatized. Profit is privatized, but the risks are socialized. That's the country we live in right now. It's corporate welfare. So that, in other words, somebody's making big profits by burning coal, but the rest of us are the ones who pay the price when we get sick. And Occupy's addressing that kind of social inequity and financial inequity. So, yeah, I've been going to whenever I can. It's a hike for me to get into New York. But I went on May Day, and right now, in fact, this morning, the occupiers are very, very unhappy with the almost, you'd call it a media blackout about what happened on Monday, which was an enormous march. There were tens of thousands of people. So, you know, somebody said 50,000. I don't know. But it was... there were so many people marching down Broadway, all the way from Bryant Park to Battery Park at the very southernmost part of the island. And when you were standing there, you'd look all the way up Broadway, all the way down. We took over the entire street. It was huge, and yet there was hardly any. In fact, some of the media were saying, oh, it really fizzled. And we were all going like, fizzled? We live in a world of propaganda. They're not reporting the truth. So people are quite unhappy right now about the May Day coverage.
This is Alex Smith. You've been listening to Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Gail Sawicki from New Jersey. She's an activist who is running a kind of one-woman campaign to wake us up to the continuing clouds of air pollution that kill people and trees and plants of all kind. You can find her blog at Wits End and more links to the ongoing stories of tree deaths around the world in my blog at ecoshock.info. Gail, thank you so much.
Thank you, Alex. I appreciate it.
It's been fun and sad, though, and worrying, but that's what makes good radio. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
I talk to the trees, but they don't listen to me. I talk to the stars, they never hear me.
Whether you accept climate change science or not, nobody disputes the fact that carbon dioxide levels are growing in the atmosphere as we burn fossil fuels. That changes the way plants grow. Various experts, including some climate modelers, count on increased plant growth as carbon dioxide rates go up in the atmosphere. Others have even promised we'll feed a new, more heavily populated planet with this extra growth. Is it true? Our guest is Lisa Ainsworth, Assistant Professor of Plant Biology and Adjunct Professor of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois. She is co-author of one of the more cited papers on the effects of increased carbon dioxide on plant growth. Lisa, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you.
I've learned from your work that we can't just ask the simple question, how do plants respond to CO2? Because nature has evolved at least four different ways for land-based plants to use carbon dioxide. I wonder if you could briefly just describe those types of plants for the non-scientist.
Sure. Many of our crops are so-called C3 plants, or they use a C3 photosynthetic mechanism. What that means is that they fix CO2 from the atmosphere with an enzyme called Rubisco, and they do that in the mesophyll cells. With this mechanism of photosynthesis, current levels of CO2 don't saturate the rate of photosynthesis. And so plants with C3 photosynthesis include soybean and wheat and rice, so many important food crops. And they also include, you know, most trees. I think there's only one exception to that rule. Have this sort of photosynthesis. And so all of these plants, when given more carbon dioxide, they generally increase their rates of photosynthesis. You can contrast this with so-called C4 plants, and those include maize. And so C4 plants kind of have a supercharged photosynthetic process. And so what they do is they initially fix carbon dioxide via a different enzyme called pep carboxylase into a C4 acid. And then they transport that C4 acid into specialized cells called bundle sheath cells where the Rubisco enzyme is held in C4 plants. And then they take that C4 acid and they decarboxylate it, so take a CO2 off of that C4 acid, and then Rubisco does its job. The difference here is that this mechanism provides a way to increase the concentration of CO2 within those bundle sheath cells, and so Rubisco is essentially saturated by CO2. And so plants that have this mechanism called C4 photosynthesis include corn and sorghum, so some important crops as well. Many of the grasses, the very productive grasses that you find in savannas and other grasslands are also C4. And so it's true that natural selection has evolved different mechanisms of photosynthesis, and so not all plants will respond directly to an increase in carbon dioxide concentration in the same way.
Fair enough. And you and other scientists have developed a new study technique known as free air CO2 enrichment. You call it FACE for short. Why is there a need to go beyond the greenhouse techniques that were used previously?
So what FACE allows is for plants to be grown under high CO2 in the field, and so no enclosures are used at all. So plants are rooted in the ground. There's no disruption of the continuum of water from the soil through the plant to the atmosphere. So that exchange is natural. Plants receive, you know, normal solar radiation and normal precipitation for whatever normal may be in the area that these experiments are. This is important because this probably comes as no surprise to anyone. When you grow a house plant inside your house or when you grow it outside, it's kind of a very different sort of plant. And the same is true for growing a soybean in a controlled environment or in a greenhouse versus growing it outside. You have much more light outside. You have a completely free rooting environment. You have more wind, and that causes the plant to have a slightly different stature. So you have more robust or hardy plants outside. You also have more pests and diseases in the natural world. And so it's quite important contextually to do these experiments in a real world environment.
Well, why don't we begin with trees? What does open air testing show about the impact of increasing CO2 on the trees?
For trees, for many of the forests, when they're grown or exposed to high CO2, for some of the longest experiments have now been run for about a decade, what we find is that initially there's an increase in productivity of these forests. And so if you measure something like total carbon gain by the forest in a given year, say, it's higher in elevated CO2. Where the plants put that carbon is interesting. There's an increase in allocation to fine roots. And so there's more carbon that goes below ground. There's also an increase in above-ground biomass for trees exposed to high CO2. And so some of the longest-running experiments were at the Duke Forest in North Carolina. There was also a long-term experiment in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. And these two experiments also had a nitrogen component of their experiments. And these were interesting studies because this sort of the law of limiting resources would suggest that as you add more carbon, something else is going to become limited. And nitrogen is what people had long hypothesized would become the limiting nutrient, at least in the temperate northern hemisphere. And in the case of the experiment at Oak Ridge, that's what was seen. It appeared that nitrogen limitation did develop in the later years of that experiment. And so the increase in growth wasn't sustained. Interestingly, at the Duke experiment, there was kind of a decade-long increase in above-ground production, in part because nutrient cycling was more rapid there. And so there was more increased availability of nitrogen.
Well, what level of CO2 did you expose the plants to, and when do scientists predict we'll reach those levels in our atmosphere?
Okay, that's a really good question. So both of these experiments that I just talked about at Duke and at Oak Ridge exposed plants to about 550 parts per million CO2, and that's about the concentration that's expected for the year 2050, about halfway through this century.
That's not that far away.
That's not far away at all, no. Of course, when these experiments were initiated, it was 20 years ago, and so it seemed a bit further away than it does today. But one of the trends, certainly in emissions over the last decade, is that they've been increasing at a faster rate than previously. Every year, we're now increasing the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere by nearly 2 parts per million. This is really a rapid and precipitous rise in CO2. And so far, to date, there hasn't been any agreements to really slow that rate.
Right. This is Radio EcoShock with plant specialist Lisa Ainsworth from the Department of Plant Biology at the University of Illinois. Lisa, let's go straight to one of the pressing issues for all humans, the impacts of increasing CO2 on crops. Can you talk to us about the big ones like wheat, corn, or some people call it maize, and rice?
Sure. We talked a little bit before about how corn has a mechanism of photosynthesis called C4. So it's sort of a supercharged mechanism of photosynthesis where the rate of photosynthesis is already saturated by current atmospheric CO2 concentrations. And so when we've done experiments growing corn in the Midwest at high CO2, we haven't measured any increase in yield. And so what we expect is that in high CO2, unless water is limiting, we may not see a direct effect of elevated CO2 on yield. In contrast, when we grow soybean at the same site, basically in the same soil under the same water conditions, when we grow them at elevated CO2, and these are concentrations, again, around 550 to 580 parts per million, we see an increase in yield of about 15% on average. Rice and wheat have a similar response as soybean, so on average, when you grow them at 550 parts per million, we see about a 15% stimulation in yield.
But we might have to keep the nitrogen coming to the fields as long as the natural gas keeps coming to provide that. Is that correct?
That is correct. The stimulation is greater under higher nitrogen. If nitrogen isn't provided, then the stimulation in production is less. Those experiments were mostly done in wheat. There has been some work in rice as well. Soybean, of course, fixes nitrogen from the atmosphere. It has an association with rhizobium, which is a bacteria that can fix nitrogen. We don't fertilize soybean typically in Illinois because it has this nitrogen fixation capacity. But we do heavily fertilize the corn that comes before the nitrogen, so there is some there in the soil.
And I've heard that CO2 increases might actually reduce the nutrition in plants, forcing herbivores to consume more just to get the same diet. Is that true?
That is true. And so at the leaf level, what happens when you grow plants in high CO2 is first there's a faster rate of photosynthesis, and so that's the rate at which CO2 is basically taken out of the atmosphere and fixed into a sugar in the plant. So plants make more sugars and they store more sugars in their leaves. If there are more sugars in the leaves, then that dilutes the concentration of nitrogen. So if a bug takes a bite of the leaf, it's getting more sugars and less nitrogen. And similarly, if you look at the grains of many crops that are grown under high CO2, you also have a lower nitrogen content in the grains. And so there is certainly some concern that in a high CO2 world, there may be less nutrients in the grains as well.
One of the reasons you studied increased CO2, it seems to me, in the paper that I read, was to double-check crop production assumptions made by climate modelers like the Hadley Center in England. Is that true, and what did you find out about their assumption?
Yeah, that is certainly true. And so what we were trying to do in the field is just to determine whether the magnitude of yield response, say production response, was the same as what we would predict from a controlled environment study. And many of the early models used the data from controlled environments, because that's what's available, to then project what future production would be. And so what we found was that the magnitude of the response was lower in the field. And so While we predicted about, you know, I said about a 15%, a little less than a 15% stimulation in yield from the field at concentrations of about 550, the controlled environment studies projected about a 30% stimulation in, say, wheat and soybean and rice yields at that same elevated CO2 concentration. And so one of the concerns, of course, is, you know, that there's an overestimation of the potential for high CO2 to stimulate yields. And certainly that was something that was borne out in many of the FACE experiments, not just the one here in Illinois, but also FACE experiments in Germany and in China and Japan.
Lisa Ainsworth, it's my impression that the free air CO2 enrichment studies do not try to calculate the other impacts of climate change, like drought or high night temperatures on plants. But you did find more CO2 might help plants use less water in the future. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. And so I guess there's two things there. I'll address the water issue first. So all plants, it seems, both C3 and C4 plants, reduce the model conductance in elevated CO2. And so stomata are the pores that are on the leaves, and that they allow CO2 to enter the leaf, and they also allow for water to leave the leaf. And so they're important in the exchange of water between the plant and the atmosphere, and they're certainly very important in carbon entering the plant, carbon dioxide entering the plant. And so all plants reduce their stomatal conductance at elevated CO2. There are just a few exceptions, but the vast majority of plants reduce their stomatal conductance at elevated CO2. And what we found is at 550 parts per million, so the concentration kind of for the middle of this century, they reduce stomatal conductance by about 20%. And so what this means is that the plants are using less water. So if there's less conductance, there's less evapotranspiration from the canopy, and that can improve soil moisture status. And so what that means is that many plants can be more water use efficient, have a higher water use efficiency at elevated CO2. Most of the work that we've published from the FACE site has only looked at the effects of elevated CO2, but there is current experimentation where we are catching rain in awnings, so providing a drought treatment to look at the interactions of elevated CO2 in drier soils. And experiments also being led by other colleagues are using infrared heaters to heat the canopy to look at the interactions of higher temperatures in elevated CO2. Because while decades of research has now really looked at climate change impact kind of singularly, we've studied in much detail the effects of rising CO2 on plant processes, the interactions are much more difficult to predict. We certainly are starting those experiments looking at the interactive effects of elevated CO2 and higher temperatures or elevated CO2 and drought.
Well, if plants have an ability to use less water, that sounds like a good thing if we run into more drought, as has been predicted for the subtropics. But it also might change the formation of things like clouds from rainforests, or it could change, make the soil so soggy that we get more flooding. Maybe I'm just not sure that's a good thing.
I think that you're right. It's going to depend on where you are on the planet, and that's going to make a big difference. And certainly the magnitude of, say, a particular drought and the ability of high CO2 to ameliorate a mild drought is clear, but a very severe drought, it may not be a good thing. If a plant grows very rapidly in a high CO2 environment, puts down lots of biomass, and then there's a very, very severe drought, that plant may feel that drought more quickly or may sense that drought more quickly. So it may not always be a good thing, that's true. In terms of modeling the impact on things like stream flow or land atmosphere exchange, I think that there could be benefits, but there also could be negative impacts of changes in water flux between the canopy and the ecosystem.
Well, in your paper in 2004, you noted that open-air CO2 tests have been done in Japan, New Zealand, Switzerland, and several places in the United States, but not yet in the tropics or subtropics, where most of the world's biomass currently grows. Have there been more tests since then to improve our information?
There have not in the tropics. So that is still an area where we have very little information. And part of that is just the matter of building the infrastructure in those areas. It's certainly more difficult. It's more of a challenge. But to date, there have not been any FACE studies in the tropics. And there have also been very few open-top chamber studies in the tropics. So we know very little about how the tropical rainforest will respond to rising CO2. We also know very little about how the African savannas will respond, and those are basically the two most productive ecosystems on the planet.
Wow. Are there other big unanswered questions about plant growth in a climate-changed world that you would like to see people study?
Well, I think those are two of the big unknowns. I think that the, as I mentioned before, understanding the interactions or being able to accurately predict what happens when there's high temperatures and there's less precipitation and high CO2 and maybe more or less pollution, depending on where you are. I think that understanding those interactions is also very, very critical.
Yeah, because I'm thinking of a 2009 presentation that Sir James Lovelock, he showed a map to the Royal Society projecting widespread deserts in the subtropics in future centuries if climate change continues, and that would certainly change a lot of our projection about future crop yields, wouldn't it?
It certainly would. I mean, I think that, you know, we haven't actually even talked about how land use change could feed back on this, and that obviously has a big impact on, we get shifts in ecosystems like you just talked about, or if there's continued land use change, particularly in the tropics, that can also feed back very rapidly on the climate and on the potential for different ecosystems to exist in a place.
Do you recommend other papers or websites where people could find out more about this subject?
There's a network of face sites. So SoyFace has its own website. And if you're interested in the work that we're doing here in Illinois on soybean and corn, and that website is www.igb.illinois.edu and then /soyface. That's SoyFace.
I think I'll put that in my EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info for people who want to grab that link.
And then the Oak Ridge National Laboratory also has a face site, kind of a database of the Aspen face and the Duke face. There was a site in the Nevada desert, and there was also one in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Aspen face was in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And so that site is public.ornl.gov/face.
Okay, well, I'll put those links in and a couple of others that I've found. We've just been peering into the murky future of plant growth in a carbon-enriched atmosphere. Our guest has been Lisa Ainsworth, Assistant Professor of Plant Biology and Adjunct Assistant Professor of Crop Sciences at the University of Illinois. Lisa Ainsworth, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Our theme music this week is Canadian folk artist Bruce Coburn, If a Tree Falls, live in Montreal in 2005. We also heard brief clips of I Talk to the Trees by Thomas L. Thomas in 1950, and updated by Masha Karela from her album Speak Low, Berlin 2007. Spring is coming earlier than ever, and plants are blooming sooner according to new research just published in the journal Nature. British scientific bodies and nature lovers have kept such records going back to 1875. Spring is now at least 5 days earlier, with some plants flowering 8 times faster than climate models predicted. The insects are keeping pace, breeding earlier and more often. In the Australian documentary, there is a shot of a forest in Spain that suddenly died. Just a quick picture. The whole thing has died. Even though I've seen millions of dying trees with my own eyes right here in British Columbia, I was shocked. That one photo, and all it means, hurt me deep inside. I'm Alex Smith, your reporter. As I limp off to lick my green wounds, the forest calls out to us. Will anybody hear?
U.S. forest ecologist Dr. Craig Allen sees the situation in WA as typical of the trends being observed elsewhere in the world. He's documented over 100 examples of large-scale tree deaths in the past 25 years.
We see all around the world in places where there have been droughts, that drought, particularly droughts and heat waves, trigger mass waves of mortality. No major forest type is immune.
Across the western U.S., tree death rates have more than doubled in the past few decades.
Where I work in northern New Mexico, we see everything from grasses and shrubs to trees dying.
Die-off events are quick and dramatic.
There may be insects and fungal pests that emerge at that point in time, but underlying it is the physiological stress on the trees that compromises their defenses. You could think of it actually sort of like HIV in humans. HIV doesn't directly kill people, but by compromising our immune systems, it makes us vulnerable to secondary, you know, viruses and other things that can kill us. It's similar in trees.
The effect climate change may have on our forests is a huge concern. But an even greater worry, how will dying trees affect the climate? In 2005, the heart of the world's biggest rainforests suffered a drought so hot and severe, it turned the Amazon jungle from a carbon sink to a carbon source. A second, once-in-a-century drought happened 5 years later.
So what we're seeing in these forest die-off events around the world are trees passing the tipping point of stress, the thresholds of mortality. Unfortunately, we don't know very much about these thresholds at this point.